Welcome to another episode of Professional Awesome Hypercritical Radio. Today's show is presented by Fuel Lab. Fuel Lab has been a proud supporter of Professional Awesome for quite some time now. We have their fuel surge tank in our S2000 as well. It's been using their brushless fuel pumps in our Evo for a while. Great products. Be sure to go there. Check out their website. Even check out their new quick change fuel surge tank. And courtesy of us, you get a special discount code. Just type in Tyrone at checkout and you get a little bit off. So do me a favor, do us a favor, and go check it out. And while you're at it, might as well give us the goddamn reviews I keep asking for. But anyways, to the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Professional Awesome Racing's Hypercritical Radio. I'm Hayden Lowe, and I bought a new mic for today. And I'm joined by
Michael Lewin
and Devin Giles.
And yeah. Dan decided he wanted to be a bitch and actually work on the race car instead of talking with his friends, so we're down a person.
Yeah, and your new mic, we can hear you like moving in a chair now, so just so you know.
Oh, I love my life. I can't even click the mouse.
Nope.
Can't suggest breathing.
Nope.
Oh.
You gotta be perfect now. See? This is what happens when you get better stuff. Starting to pick up your heartbeat. I can hear it.
I'm going to have to get one of those, like,
100%.
I'm going to have to put one of those fuzzy condoms over my mic, so it's okay. Okay.
But, all right, so a couple things we'll talk about today. So this one's going to be a little bit technical. I'm going to talk about...
Mike is going to be the only one talking. Anyway.
No, you guys are going to talk shit. But we're going to talk about something that I complain about often, and that is because people don't understand it, much like aerodynamics, much like suspensions, much like everything else in the world. We're going to talk about steering systems. So we're going to go through the basics of a normal steering system. Then we're going to talk about electro-hydraulic, fully electric, different types of electric versus column-mounted, rack-mounted systems, either pinion drives or parallel ball screws. You'll understand what I'm saying here soon. And then we're going to talk about feel, and then I'm going to be annoyed because, yeah, that's really where the problems come from. Because people don't understand enough about these systems to understand what they're actually feeling, and they trick themselves, and hence the reason why feel is a really, in my mind, a bullshit term that people use, because it's a lie. It's a preference. It has nothing to do with engineering, and so I hate talking about it, especially because, yeah, I measured these things. So I used to be a power steering engineer. Basically, I was an application engineer, which designed power steering systems. I was a gear engineer. I was a pump engineer. I was part of the EPS team. I did ADOS functionality. So I've done everything that you can do in a power steering sense, from driving around a system with a computer to letting the system drive itself, to designing a system so that it feels good. Feels good. I just air quoted the shit out of that. We all know that. So that it feels good to a particular individual, because that individual exists at each major brand. And so, yeah, we're going to go through some of that. Now I'm going to breathe for a second, and then I'm not going to breathe for 30 minutes.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
Yeah, that's how this works. All right. So,
real quick, separately, before we get into this, just a general question.
I just took my breath. Now I'm fine.
This is... Okay. But this is... I guess this is... Yeah, I don't think I've ever thought about this before. But, like, say just my Volkswagen GTI that's sitting out in the driveway right now, the 2021, the new one. Is there something you could plug in? Can you plug into the ECU and then just tune away the way my electric steering is set up?
No. Different? Not really. The steering system ECU is very different from an OBD2 access ECU. Like, and this is one of the things we'll talk about. It's that aftermarket electric power steering systems,
right,
in terms of their functionality and programming, are extremely limited.
Okay.
On the market. They are not... There's not many systems that are fully programmable. Even the systems that are expensive, which we'll talk about, are not truly programmable in the way that an OE level is capable of programming them. So,
but they set them up, and then they just... That's it. OEM level things. Like, they'll set them up for a vehicle, and then you just don't touch them.
Right.
Unless you replace them.
Right. So I'll talk about why that is and what that means, and that comes back to the feel conversation. All right, so we're going to talk about basic steering systems on older cars, because now almost every car has electric power steering. So becoming incredibly prevalent. So we'll talk about the older systems first, which is hydraulic fluid, right? A power steering system with hydraulic fluid. So the oldest systems, or truck systems, basically commercial vehicle systems, will have power steering fluid. That power steering fluid obviously comes out of a power steering pump, which is generally mechanically driven. Some systems now have, if they're not fully electric, they're electrohydraulic, meaning that they have an EPHS pump or an EPHS or EHPS, depending on who you're talking to, electrohydraulic steering system or electrohydraulic steering pump. And they go through, the system is pumped, you know, the fluid is pumped, and it pumps into either a gear or a rack. A gear is generally a truck kind of thing. Or if you go back in time enough, plenty of cars had steering gears in them in the past. So you're talking like third-gen Camaros, kind of the 80s, pre-80s, you'll have some steering gears, which is basically a box, right? They call it a steering box as well. It's a big chamber with a rack, or with a, the rack that slides back and forth. It's a big, basically block-looking cylinder, and pressure goes on either side of it, and then that moves a pitman arm, which then connects to a bunch of lateral links, and that connects to your steering system, to your, basically your tie rod ends.
So been told that stuff is garbage.
So yeah, we'll talk about why and what, right? So that's the important part here. And then the other side of it is, if you don't have a steering box, steering gear, you have generally a rack and pinion. Now, there are other types of systems, and I'm not going to talk about them because, frankly, most people never going to see them, never going to touch them, definitely not going to be using them in a race car. So we're just going to leave them alone in this world. And so talking about the older systems, we'll talk about what's common between them. So we have a power steering pump and then portions of a power steering pump. So most people don't understand how a power steering pump works. And that's a problem, because people often have power steering pump issues, whether it be overheating or and a lot of factors in a basic system, in a basic power steering system, come from the fact that the pump is not either correct anymore for your system, right? It could have been stock, but it doesn't do what you want it to do at this point. Or you're doing something different, like putting too much load into it comparatively, right? You could have stock tires, and now you have big fat slicks with a bunch of air on it, and now the power steering pump, which is the determiner of physical force in this whole equation, is no longer up to the task, right? And so there's a lot of things that you have to understand about the power steering pump to understand, you know, basically what you need to do, or what you need to be looking for in a system when you're building that out, or you do have a problem. So I hope that this at least helps some people make better decisions about what's wrong, especially when they have a power steering problem. So a power steering pump, from its basic form, is either belt or gear driven. It is, what it does is basically the power steering pump pumps fluid and then compresses that fluid into a pressure. That pressure is then forced to the power steering gear or rack, and then that is transmitted into linear force, and that is directed into the tie rod ends, which basically obviously turns us into steering force, and then you get your right left rotation. Now, we can go into so many variables and all these things. We're not going to go necessarily into suspension setups in terms of alignment, because that will take me forever. So we're going to focus just on the components right now, because even though the alignment and the setup of these parts has a massive impact on how they function, we can't go that far. So the big things here at a power steering pump.
Too big brain. That's behind our paywall. So yeah.
Yes, I'm paywall. So a power steering pump has a couple major components that are important here. You have your main housing, you have your end plates, you have your cam, rotor, vanes, and a flow control valve or a spool valve, depending on who you talk to. Right. And so the basic function is you have an input shaft. That input shaft is connected to, like we said, the pulley on normal cars, or maybe it's connected to a gear system on commercial vehicles or other vehicles. It can, obviously, like I said, be connected to an electric motor for electrohydraulic. The input to that pump is there is a rotor and a cam. A cam is basically literally a lobed piece of steel that has pockets on either, they're 180 degrees from each other. Imagine in your head, 180 degrees from each other, there are pockets. And the rotor sits in the middle of it, and it's diametrically extremely close to the minimum diameter of that lobe, that elliptical shape. Then in the larger area, right, the largest size, there's a certain amount of volume. And that volume on either side is your cam volume. So if you hear a power steering pump or a cam size or a pump size, a certain volume, whether it be for normal cars, let's say 5cc, 2cc, 3cc, 4cc, that means how much fluid is pumped per cam side, right? So it's the cam volume is cc's of fluid that it's able to pump in a rotation, right? Makes sense. So if you go up in size, you can go to commercial vehicles that need a lot more flow. Then you can get up to 18 cc, you can get up to 32, 36 cc. Some of those pumps, when you use the power steering pump, also for other auxiliaries on a truck, let's say you have a dump truck, or you got a refuse truck, a garbage truck, where it starts using some of that power steering fluid to run hydraulic rams or otherwise, which is possible and does happen, you need a lot more flow, right? And because of that, you can get up into those really large pumps, which are 36 cc. Some go even higher than that. Some use auxiliary pumps as well. So that's a possibility. So the cam determines the size and the amount of flow per revolution. Rotor sits in the middle of it. Then the rotor has vanes that sit into slots, basically very highly machined, very technically machined slots. The vanes go in and out of the rotor. And what it does is when you're pumping fluid, the vanes contract all the way in to the slots in the rotor and then expand all the way out into the cam size. So they make little pockets where fluid is allowed to go in through the inlet and out through the outlet and is compressed. So if you imagine it opens up on the one side of the cam, like basically as it's growing in that elliptical shape, and then gets smaller on the other side of that elliptical shape, that decrease is actually forcing fluid through a smaller opening under pressure now, and that's where your actual pressure is coming from. Then the vanes get pushed back into the rotor. Generally, there's 8, 10, 6, 8, 10, 12, depending on the pump, and those vanes slide in and out constantly. There's pressure, it's called undervane pressure, that actually pushes them out against the sidewall in the cam that holds them against the outside of the cam. So if you can imagine, it's literally just steel on steel of a vane pushing against a cam to hold fluid in there at enormous pressures. So that's basically what's holding it. There's a small bit of loss, but it's really not as high as you think it is, because all these precision components are machined in a way that metal sliding on sliding, basically metal on metal contact, the fluid is helping stagnate some of that fluid around the area of that contact, which then allows it to become a pump, right?
What kind of tolerances are
very tight
aimed parts? Like
very for the verticality or the concentricity and the verticality on the parts is you know, 10,000 spaced. So it's Ooh. Important
tight.
And you can reasonably
can you break down your terminology for people that don't know what the fuck you're talking about, eh?
With
concentricity and verticality?
That's correct.
Oh, so like concentricity is the two circles and how closely they meet. Basically, the center point of the circles needs to be extremely tight between the rotor and the cam. Otherwise, the volumes will be different on each side, and pressure balance is very important. If you can think about it as if the pressure is unequal on either side of the cam, that can be very detrimental, obviously, to the whole process, and can literally bend input shafts or cause other problems. You're talking about, obviously, in a normal power steering system, let's say for a normal car, you can go from 1,000 to 1,500 PSI pretty easily. On a commercial vehicle, you can go up to 2683, which is 185 bar. So we're talking normal cars, 75 to 100 bar. Commercial vehicles, 150 to 185 bar. And they go up higher than that, 195, 200.
What you're saying is if shit is out of concentricity, then you're going to bend something.
Yeah, I mean, the rotor. Yeah, the rotor is floating on a rotor is floating basically on a bed of fluid that is equal and opposite forces, right?
Right.
And if you have unequal forces, then that becomes a problem, right?
How about verticality?
Because, yeah, and so then verticality is what I'm talking about is verticality or flatness on the face of cam. That surface needs to be basically perfectly vertical as much as possible, because the vanes cannot pivot. They don't have, there's not fluid flow, or there's not room for the actual vanes to do anything but move in and out of a specific plane, right? And so they can only move in and out of a plane if they are asked to move up or down and meet a face of a cam that is not flat, that's not perfectly vertical or not perfectly flat, then there's going to be a sealing issue there, right? So you're going to have a little pocket of an issue where fluid's going to flow past it. And if fluid comes out of that area, then every little ounce that comes out of that area is loss, right? It's just loss efficiency, right? So that becomes a problem. And so all the cams are hard ground so that you have, right, that perfect shape as much as possible. All the rotors are height ground so that their height is perfect, because if their height isn't perfect, then that becomes a problem. Your cam and your rotor need to be the exact same height so that you have the same, basically the plates, which are on the outsides of holding this whole assembly together, are perfectly smashed together. They're technically not the same height, but I'm not going to go into it because it's annoying. But they're basically perfectly matched so that they don't have leakage.
Sure.
The next part about that, like I said, is that once it kind of pushes in and out of the flow is pushed out in and out of the actual pump, comes from the inlet to the outlet. Obviously, that CC, like I talked about, that CC I talked about is the amount of flow that the pump is able to produce. Now, the amount of pressure that it's able to produce is a completely different part of the pump, right? That's where we get into the flow control, the spool valve, right? And so the outlet of the fluid, the two halves of the cam, funnel to the same outlet, which is the outlet of the pump. They go through a port that has the flow control. Now, the flow control does a variety of things, which is very interesting. The flow control not only controls the output flow of the pump, but it also controls the pressure relief on the pump, both things together as one. And how that works is that when you're not asking for flow, there is an orifice on the outlet of the pump. An orifice is basically a restricted hole, which only allows a certain amount of fluid through. And what that orifice does, it decides how much fluid flow the system will allow. And what it does is it causes a pressure differential from the inlet, or sorry, from the outlet of the pump versus the inside area of the pump that has pressurized fluid. So once the fluid goes into the cavity where the flow control is, it needs to go out an orifice. So that orifice causes a little bit of restriction, and the flow control will shuttle back and forth in a basically in a very tightly controlled tube, if you will. Depending on the output flow need of the vehicle, it will either move in or out. And if it moves in, it means more fluid goes out. And if it moves out, it means more fluid stays in the pump and recirculates. And people use different terminology, so you can reverse those if you want. But the point is that in one position, it will let all the fluid out of the pump if needed. So let's say you're turning really, really fast. We generally spec things for 1.5 hand wheels per second, which is pretty fast if you think about it, right? 540 RPM, basically. 540 degrees per second, sorry. And so if you can turn a wheel at 540 degrees per second, that's a pretty quick turn, right? If you think about what you're doing. Sometimes we go higher than that. Sometimes we go lower than that. But let's say 1.5 hand wheels per second. If you're turning pretty quickly there, you need a certain amount of flow to fill the volume in either the rack, basically in the power steering gear, or in your rack and pinion. You need a certain amount of volume to fill that volume. You need a certain amount of flow. And so if you're the faster you steer, the faster you need to fill up that volume, right? That makes sense.
Sure. Yeah.
Nope. And so following that flow control, what it's doing is when you ask for a lot of flow, it's opening fully, basically allowing all the, or it's technically closing, but it's letting all the flow out of the pump. And it goes, all of it is going to the power steering mechanism, whatever it may be, maybe the gear or the rack and pinion, right? Makes sense. And that allows you to turn at 1.5 hand wheels per second or whatever the specification is for that particular vehicle. Now, if you don't want all that flow and you're just driving on the highway, right? We're just driving straight. What happens is the power steering pump then has that flow control shifts and internally recirculates the flow inside of it. So it basically opens a passage from the inlet to the outlet. Sorry, outlet to the inlet. I should say it that way. Outlet to the inlet, and then recirculates that flow. This is why there are power steering coolers.
Makes sense.
That's the reason.
Yep. That makes sense.
Because what happens when you compress fluid?
Right. You got to have
it hot.
Be going somewhere.
It gets hot. And so then if you're compressing fluid, you have no control but to compress that fluid, right? Because that's how the power steering pump works. It's directly connected to a belt, which is connected to an input shaft, which is connected to the rotor, cam, and it's going to push fluid no matter what you do. But you're not using it. So you're going to compress it one way or another. And if you compress it, it creates heat. And then if you compress it and bring it back into the pump almost immediately at a very high level, right? Like so when you're driving down the road, your power steering pressures might be 150 PSI, 100 PSI. There's targets. Let's say we target under 100 PSI. So that means that we have a constant 100 PSI of outlet pressure no matter what, even though the wheels aren't moving, even though you're not steering, right? You're not turning left or right. You have a constant pressure of 100 PSI. That's kind of, let's call it the centering pressure. That's what it is, okay? So it's the pressure if you had zero, that means that your system's manual, right? but you're always going to have a little bit, especially with a power steering system. And you might have it 100 psi. And so that flow is recirculating within the pump. And as it's recirculating in the pump, it's just getting hotter. And that's a problem because, one, you don't have a lot of power steering fluid that can control that heat. And then, two, as the fluid gets hotter, it gets more, I always get it backwards. It gets thinner, right? We know this, right?
Viscous, and, right?
Is
it less viscous or is it viscous?
Less viscous. Yeah, right? Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it gets thinner.
So yeah, but better.
Right, yeah.
It's less viscous.
Is it?
Correct. Okay. It's less thick. Yeah, correct.
Yeah. And so because of that, that can cause problems within the power steering system because if it gets too hot, right? If it gets too hot, then we all know that fluids at a higher temperature don't control basically their ability to hold together molecularly to stop physical contact between metal and on metal parts becomes less capable of doing that, right? And power steering fluid is garbage.
Yeah.
Power steering fluid as a whole is an absolutely garbage fluid for doing this. But it is the lesser of evils in a lot of cases, and that's why people use power steering fluid. Where engine oil is far better at stopping metal-to-metal contact, but power steering fluid or engine oil is also much better at attacking seals that are internal to the pump and the gear and the steering rack. So the problem was, if you look back in the day, they used to use motor oil, but the zinc content in that motor oil, zinc phosphorus content in that motor oil, which is great for metal-to-metal contact, would eat away the seals and cause leaks in the power steering system.
So rather than try to improve the seals, they just said, let's fuck with a different fluid.
At the time, it was the 80s.
I mean, that makes sense.
It was the 80s. So, sure. You know, rubber basically was, you know, HNBR was the hotness, and that's the best they could do. And it was destroyed by zinc. And what are you going to do, right? It was destroyed by the constituents of the ADPAC and the actual fluid. And that caused a problem where power steering fluid or ATF or whatever, all the same, basically. Some of the power steering fluids are different now, but basically ATF is not necessarily made for that. It's got anti-foaming agents. It's got a lot of different factors in it that make it good for staying clean, being able to deal with dirt, those types of things, but it's not necessarily great for a power steering system. But it's what we have, and it's what we use. Hopefully that changes. It's gotten better over the years, but whatever. So the whole point here is that when it gets hotter, you'll have more likely to have metal amount of contact. We know that from engines. But you don't have that heavy amount of zinc and phosphorus that helps protect your engine. So it'll have a tendency to break down. It also has smaller molecular chains, right? So I don't know if we ever talked about that, but from an engine oil standpoint, the molecular chains and the length of those molecular chains have play a factor in the ability of the shear strength of the oil. The longer they are, the tendency that they are stronger and able to handle more shear factor. Well, ATF's no good at that. So great. And so you don't want that power steering fluid to get very warm. Maximum generally recommended, you'll see ranges anywhere from 220 or 100 degrees C, 212, but 220F to 250, 221C will be a general recommendation. Going much above that, you can see diminished life cycle, and it's generally not recommended that you get up in that range. Now, normally driving down the road, your power steering system might get to 150, 160C, maybe 170C, or sorry, F. Woo! F.
So you were saying C. I'm like, holy shit, that's high.
No, yeah, it's way too high. So F, yeah. 150F, 160F would be normal. Sometimes even up to the 80, 180. But you really don't want to get it much higher than that, especially driving down the road with no force. Now, we'll do testing on a vehicle. You'll do a figure eight test. So you'll do eight figure eights in a row, which is obviously going fully as fast as you can, steering left fully, then right fully in a figure eight pattern at about 10, 15 miles per hour. So there's a little bit of centripetal force there that's putting some load on the tire and the steering system. And you measure your starting temperature and your ending temperature, and it has to be within a certain range. Obviously, we can't let it go above a certain range. Another test we'll do to ensure that a power steering pump is capable of handling certain situations is you functionally hold it against its relief pressure and you put full maximum output flow and pressure. And so when you do that, then you're building heat within the pump because the pump has to build enough pressure to meet its pressure rating, whether it be 100 bar, 150 bar, 185 bar, 200 bar, whatever it may be. And that takes a lot of energy, and that creates a lot of heat. And then you restrict the outlet so that you're functionally, if you imagine you're in a car and imagine that you're at a, let's say you're parallel parked and you're stupid and you steer into a, curb as hard as you can, and you're completely unaware that you're steering into a curb and the car isn't moving anywhere and the power steering system's not moving anywhere, and you just build a lot of pressure with basically very little flow, right? Not much is going in or out, but you're trying to move against an object that's not going to let you move, right? So that's that test. That's fun. Burnout test. And again, fluid temperatures can't get above a certain number, and I can't obviously tell anybody details about that, but can't get above a certain number, and the pump has to be able to last a certain amount of time. So that's a general on how to deal with those kinds of things in terms of efficiency and flow. And so I'll go back a little bit, is that for the flow control, I talked about how it handles flow output requirements, but how it handles pressure output requirements is that on the back of the spool, there is a little orifice as well, and fluid flows to the backside. And there's a little spring and a poppet. And when there is a differential pressure of a certain amount, basically if there's, if you think about it, the pressure in that area that I talked about with the orifice in it will build to a certain level. And when that builds to a certain level, on the backside of the spool, there's very little pressure. Backside of the flow control, there's very little pressure on that poppet. And so when it reaches a certain range, there's a little spring in there with a little poppet. And what it will do is it'll push the poppet off its seat at, let's say, a differential of 50 PSI. And what will happen is at that point, then the spool will shift all the way one direction and recirculate everything, basically. Because now it's assuming that you've hit a dead end, right? You don't really need flow, and that's full pressure. And so it's met that pressure, and that's the output that it's capable of. And so that you tune that output, you tune your pressure requirements with different plates or different spring heights or different springs to figure out exactly how much output flow you're actually looking for, or sorry, output pressure you're looking for, and that will determine whether it's 100, 150, 185 bar pump. And so I worked on some cool projects there. I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about. Hold on one second. I'm going to look up something.
Yeah, check that NDA.
Yeah. Is Mike cool enough to say anything? Let's find out.
Is it public information yet? It should be. There's a patent. I mean, I would assume it's public information. But so one of the things I worked on, I'll talk about it. Anyway, one of the things that I worked on at my previous job is that as a pump engineer, I worked on the ability to, instead of having to arbitrarily stack plates and things like this to try to figure out what to do, I built a system so that each individual, which the plates are somewhat accurate, they're not overly accurate, but the problem is that there's a tremendous amount of work that's involved in building spools to have a certain pressure. And what's also very difficult is correlating the pressure between the pressure stands. So if you imagine we're building a little component, you can look up a spool or a flow control valve online. It looks like a little trumpet. They call it a trumpet. Correlating the pressure when you actually test it on the stand versus the pressure that's in the pump, because they act a little bit differently. So there's a lot of correlation there. So the numbers you see on the stand when you actually build the actual spool are different than necessarily that happen in the pump. So one, you got to correlate that pressure. Two, this is where people don't understand the complexity of very simple things or things that have been around for a long time. They don't understand the complexity of them and how much work has gone in to get them to get to this point, right? And so one of the things I did is that I worked on a system so that we didn't have to use plates or anything like that, and we could infinitely adjust the pressure on the spool to allow it so that we could get it bang on each time, and we could have almost basically one part number instead of having a bunch of part numbers for different springs and different plates. Yay. So that's cool. So that it allowed you to make a pump that fundamentally, if you knew what you were looking at, you could probably open up your pump and you could adjust its pressure, which don't do that, but you could.
He says, please stop.
Don't talk to a professional.
Yeah. Talk to your doctor before you take these meds.
Right. But it's interesting because you could take, you know, a pump that's maybe, right, 100 bar, and you can make it 130 bar.
That son of a bitch like a supercharger, bro.
Yeah. That doesn't help, though. More speed doesn't help. It might help. I'll tell you exactly. So this is one of the things. It might help in very specific conditions, but it doesn't make any more pressure. All it would do is make more flow, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we calculate When we calculate flow output, we calculate in the CC, right, the size of the pump, but we also calculate the RPM versus the gear ratio of the drive unit or the pulley size, right? So we know what RPM the pump will be at any given time. And this is another thing that people don't understand is that a lot of power steering systems are designed, when you have a pump, are designed for static steer requirements of 1.5 hand wheels per second. And if it's a static steer in a parking lot, that means your RPM is generally what? 800?
I mean, damn near idle. Yeah, 800 to 1200, right?
Right. And so if you have a power steering pump that the engine is running at 800 RPM and that pump, right, is, if let's say it's 1-to-1, right? It's not 1-to-1 generally, but let's say it's 1-to-1. See, the pulley size is exactly the same size as the crank pulley, right? So you have a 1-to-1 drive now. So now the pump is spinning at 800 RPM. Now I need to calculate how much flow I need to send to the rack in that car so that you can steer based on volume at 1.5 hand wheels per second. Right now, the next problem is what happens if you go faster? Now the RPM is higher, but you don't need any of that flow because now you're rarely ever, I mean, maybe if you're a track or you're drifting or whatever, you rarely need that steering speed ever again, right?
Right.
And so if you don't need that steering speed, that means that functionally what I'm doing is designing a power steering pump to work really well at parking lot speeds, but the rest of the time I've got way too much flow. Hence the reason the flow control is so important, and hence the reason why we need a cooling system of some sort. Because you're going to overflow everything at any time that you are above that RPM. That makes sense? And so sometimes people will complain, oh, I can't steer fast enough, and I tell you to rev it up a little bit and tell me if it gets better. Right?
Okay.
You can feel a hiccup, right? If you ever get in a car, just freaking rip it. If you have a power steering system that's, you know, flow-based. Freaking rip it. If you can rip it and it doesn't work for you, right? Like you feel a hiccup in it, right? It wants to stop you occasionally. If you then just rev it up to, let's say, 2,000 instead of 1,000, right? What happens then?
Okay.
So that will tell you if the pump just doesn't have enough flow at idle for what you're trying to do or not. And so this is generally never really a problem because almost everybody is already, right? Almost everybody has enough flow. Because we size the pump so that you have enough flow, even at idle. Now, what you might not have enough of is, like I said, is much more likely, which is pressure. And so people are like, oh, my pump caught, or it got my steering got super heavy. Well, your steering got heavy because you don't have enough pressure. And so, unfortunately, you can't really fix that unless you want to take the pump apart and put plates under the spring to increase that pressure, which is... Please don't do that unless you know what you're doing. Or you have a flow control, which is adjustable, which is what I talked about previously, which I worked on. So that allows you to make that change.
Is that hard to do?
Is it hard?
Yeah.
I don't call it hard because I've done it thousands of times. But if you do it wrong, you can break a lot of stuff. Because one, depending on the pump, it might not be built for the pressure. So obviously there's a lot of safety factor involved there. So if you only up it by a little bit, it's probably fine. The other problem, though, is the seals in the rack are going to be the first thing that generally go. So the power steering pump probably won't explode or cause a leak, but the power steering rack will have a tendency to leak. It'll have a propensity to leak faster or earlier than your power steering pump, right?
Okay.
And so that's a problem, right? That's a big issue, you know, when we're trying to figure out what to do there. And so all of that is to say, that is the basics of a power steering pump. Oh my gosh.
Oh boy. All right. Electric. Let's hit it.
Yeah.
Let's hear it. Give me the lowdown on your EPS.
Okay. So let me do two things.
Quiver.
Yeah, quiver. Exactly.
So let me go real quick. Electro-hydraulic pumps, right? Not connected to the engine. They're connected to an electric motor. So we'll go through MR2, MRS. Those are different, actually. MR2, older MR2 are just a pump connected to a motor running at a speed. You know, I think it's 1,500 RPM. I don't actually remember, 1,800 RPM. And so they just run at a specific speed. You just turn them on, they go. That's an old MR2 unit. They also don't have an incredible amount of pressure because we all know that MR2s don't have a lot of front end weight. So remember that. So this is coming to the swapping. Now you got to start thinking about swapping things, right? Because that's what most people here are going to have a problem with. So that's one. The MRS, Ford, fucking, what is it, Volvos. Lots of people are using Volvo pumps, Ford pumps, Porsche motorsport pump. All these pumps that are electro-hydraulic. Now, those can be a little bit different. They all of these pumps have spool valves. They're just basically pumps that are attached to a motor. But some of them have spool up and spool down speeds, meaning that they speed up or slow down depending on the demand of the output. So they'll have a pressure sensor of some sort or a flow sensor of some sort on the output of the pump, which then allows them, the pump and its smarts, to understand if it needs to speed up or slow down. You can also put it in a mode that runs at full speed all the time. I think the MRS pump runs at 4,500 RPM, something like that. That's pretty fast for a power steering pump, if I'm honest. And so if it runs at those speeds all the time, that means you're getting maximum output flow, and that's what you really want sometimes, especially when you're racing, but you need to make sure that there's a cooler on it of some sort, especially if you're going to do longer racing, longer events, because obviously, like I told you before, you've got maximum flow, which means you've got maximum heat buildup, right? Makes sense. You're also putting a lot of pressure through the system all the time. But the output between the MRS and versus the MR2 or even the Ford systems, those types of things, is that the MR2 is, I think, closer to 900 PSI, something like that. In the MRS systems, I think 1,000, where the standard power steering fluid pressures for, let's say, an Evo, an STI, or some other cars is around 1,300 PSI, you know, give or take around there, sometimes all the way up to that 100 bar, which is, you know, 1,500 PSI. And obviously, you want to match what your power steering pressures are. So if you go, if you ever want to make a change or you want to put a power steering pump in, like one of these electro-hydraulic units, what I would suggest you do is you look at your car, find a service manual, find a test for the power steering pressure in the manual. You should be able to find it for each car. It should be available there for you to be able to check, right, your power steering pump, make sure it's working right. And you're going to swap in one of these electros. Look up that car and look up a test for it as well and ensure those numbers are close, somewhat close, right? So if your old car was 1,300 PSI, look for something that's around 1,300 PSI. So like the motorsport pump, Porsche motorsport pump, that is around 1,300 PSI, 1,350 PSI, those types of things. And so because of that, that's pretty close to like an Evo, an STI, some other, you know, cars of the same era. And because of that, that's a great swap in because you're going to get consistent, similar performance, but you're going to get the added advantage, obviously, that you have that pump taken off the engine now. And if you use spool up and spool down, that could be helpful as well. So that's the biggest problem is that people put some of these pumps on and they don't know what they're looking for. They don't, one, it doesn't have enough flow. Two, it doesn't have enough pressure. Then they complain about it. They say there's something wrong. They put it in the trunk for extra weight distribution, which you can do. But remember that it has to pressure. When you turn the steel, we're going to imagine here, you're making a right-hand turn. You turn the wheel. You're demanding pressure from the rack, which I'll talk about later. I mean, I don't know if I will because I talk too much and this is already going to be too long of a podcast. You turn right, you crack open the valve, it demands some fluid pressure, the fluid starts to flow, then it has to flow all the way back to the back of the car. You have to fill up those dash six lines, whatever they may be, the pressure, you know, let's say that you don't have it on, or you have it on spool up, spool down. It has to spool up, make that pressure. It spools up extremely quickly, 50 milliseconds, 100 milliseconds maybe. Spools up, starts building that pressure hits the line, then it starts to flow. Then it fills up the rack. Then it starts pushing the tires and the, you know, starts pushing the rack, which pushes the tire on it, which pushes the steer arm, and then there you go. So there's a lot of things happening there, and that can slow down the response in the field. Now, imagine you're turning right, and you have to do a switch back to the other direction because it's a compound turn, and now you go left. That whole process has to happen again, and you feel a hiccup going over center because you don't have the flow required to turn back quickly enough because now your power steering pump is either in the back or you don't have enough flow, or whatever it may be. Those are the situations that people complain about, and they completely don't understand what they're talking about, and they don't know what to diagnose or what to check for. And so that happens often. People talk about that stuff often, and people are like, oh, just replace your pump, or do this, or do that, and it's like, that's not just like a fix anything, right? That's not what the actual problem is. Right? And even some power steering companies do that same thing. Everybody who requests a pump should know. Every company who sells a pump should know exactly what the system wants, should know the diameter of the rack, should know the length of the lines, should know the requirement for steering effort. Otherwise, you're just guessing, and it's a bad guess at that.
Yeah. So I have a question.
That's my thing.
So for some people that want to replace their power steering, mainly because it's been overworked with their current car setup, like what's a general rule of thumb that you're looking for pressure-wise?
So like I said, like if you're let's say we're working on the Porsche, right? And you want, you put some big fat daddy tires on it. We got some big, big aero on it. And now the system is incapable of meeting, basically you're turning and the steering's extremely heavy.
That's right? What I'm asking. Yep. Correct.
Yeah. That's a pressure problem, right? So you don't have enough pressure. And so what you can do is you can look at what the pressure is supposed to be for a stock pump, whether it be an electrohydraulic or otherwise. Then you can either open up your stock pump, pull out the spool, increase the pressure for the pressure relief, which is what I talked about. That's not my first choice. I would talk to somebody in a, you know, that, that builds power steering pumps and see if there's anything available first, because like I said, that's really kind of skirting the edge of what's going to be the power steering pump's going to be capable of and can cause damage, right? So you can do that as one option to increase pressure. Now, I generally don't recommend going above, much above 10%. So if you're at 1300 PSI, let's say, you don't really want to go above 1450 or 1430 or something like that. That's, you know, it's really where kind of the maximum you want to be. Mostly because the seals aren't going to survive very long, especially in a racing situation where they're being hit with full pressure all the time and they're being hit with what is potentially high, high power steering fluid temperatures. Which is also not great for the seals, right? Over the longevity, over the life of the seals. So those are two factors there. The other option, like I said, is to go and look what your standard power steering pressures are. Find a unit that has an electrohydraulic unit that could be swapped in that has a slightly higher pressure, which would then give you that 10% overhead, which could potentially help that, right? And then you have your more pressure in that regard. Now, we talked about it before, like I said, alignment factors play a large part in steering forces, right? So scrub radius, different tires, these all play a huge amount of requirements for steering force. One system may be, you could switch tires and you could change your steering force by 30%. That's not a joke. It's a lot. I could do it more than that if you wanted. But the point is, if you think about it, let's say you have a stock tire with very little scrub. Hopefully everybody on the podcast knows what scrub radius is. It's basically the freaking distance between the center line of the tire and the kingpin inclination angle and the distance between those two as they come down. And that means that if you were to imagine from a tire looking the top down and you were to turn that tire left or right, there is the center line of where the tire is actually rotating versus the center line of the actual tire. So the center point of where the turn rate or the turn radius is versus the center point of the actual tire. Those are going to be slightly different. You don't want them on top of each other. That can make for very inconsistent handling. You generally want them slightly inboard or outboard, depending. That's a different conversation. We're not going to talk about that today. But you want it inboard or outboard. And what I'm saying there is that there's a little bit of a moment there. So if you imagine and you turn with a scrub radius that is a small distance, that means that you're literally slipping tire, right, over a small contact area, and you're rotating it around a small contact area, right? Literally, the tire has to, like, you're literally dragging the tire, if you think about it, right? You're scrubbing it on the ground. That's why it's scrub radius. It's literally rotating on the ground. If you did it enough, you could wear a spot into it if you did it on concrete, right? Now, if your moment arm is wide or long, you have a high scrub radius. Well, now, that's a huge moment to the center of the tire, right? And so now that force is very much drastically increased because now you're literally moving the tire around an arc. And so the tire literally has to roll. If you have your foot on the brake while you're steering and you have a high scrub radius, it's literally physically harder. Now, if you get off the brake and the car is allowed to just move a little bit, that tire may now be able to roll because you're literally moving it around a big arc. So your scrub radius can have a drastic effect on steering forces. The next thing that can have a drastic effect there is camber, caster. Camber, if the tire is flat on the ground, that's going to be more steering force than something that has a little bit more camber. Now that comes into play here with caster, right? Caster is the lean back of the tire. If you have more or less caster, then you have jacking effects, meaning that if you turn, the physical vehicle actually gets lifted off the ground. So now, not only are you having to steer, you know, move the tires fundamentally left or right in the steering angle, but you're also attempting to lift the car off the ground. And those are called jacking forces. And so minimizing jacking forces, minimizing scrub radius will make it so that your power steering system does less work and will technically have better feedback. So, God, so here we got into feel.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is where feedback comes from.
Oh, no.
More reasonable feedback. So if you have a high scrub radius, you're going to have a lot of feedback because now the moment arm force is going to be extremely high, right? And so you're going to feel a lot what the tire does, but it's also going to be very uncomfortable because it has a tendency to cause bumps to your and other issues as well. Caster, the centering of the tire, also can have some effect on that feedback, that feel. Because if you have high caster angles, that means the car wants to self-center on its own because of the centering forces, because the jacking forces are literally pushing the car back straight, right? We think about it that way. And so we're driving on the Autobahn. That's why you see German cars have high caster versus other cars don't have as much high caster, because high caster is generally used for cars that are going at high speed because caster has a centering force. If it has a centering force, that means it's easier to drive at high speed and it's more stable because the car is always centering itself. Much like a toe or a toe-in will have a tendency to drive the wheels towards each other and will have a centering force. But if you have a toe-in vehicle with a high scrub radius, well, now you're driving a larger portion of the tire towards the inside of the tire, which causes you to heat up a tire and potentially use it more quickly and overheat it more quickly because now your centering forces are combining, causing more steering forces, and you're fucked. I haven't even gotten to the complicated parts of this yet. This is, again, why I think people have a tendency to think they know more about a problem than they potentially do because they haven't had to go through the difficulty of trying to solve, basically build something from scratch and understand exactly what they're doing when they build it. And so these are all very simple concepts from the standpoint of steering comparatively to all the calculations that I used to do to ensure that the steering system functions as it should. Yay!
All right, next question.
Whose brain is dead yet?
No. We're just thinking.
We're past that.
I hope everyone listening, I hope this is helpful. I know that I sound like a dick half the time, but I hope this is helpful. I know these
are a dick, Captain.
Yeah.
Are a dick.
Yeah, are a dick. I'm just saying.
It's one of those that, like, honestly, I felt like after having listened to you say it, I get the concept, but I'll probably enjoy going back and re-listening to this podcast again, and everything will click. I really was very tuned in on the power steering and how it works. Even though I've never taken a pump apart, I can visualize that now. I can understand that. Then after that, I got a little lost, but you know.
Yeah, and then, but go online and look at pictures and it'll all make sense. You can talk it through and you can see it. You know, you'll see the images and you'll hear me say how it kind of works. And that's all helpful. And I'm just saying that, like, humans as a generality have a tendency to minimize the complexity of things when they don't really understand the complexity of something. And this is what I'm talking about from a standpoint of even a power steering pump. People don't understand the complexity of what's sitting in front of them. And obviously power steering pumps are going away, which is, I think, a good thing in that regard, because it actually has many high tolerance components, you know, difficult tolerance components in it. And people don't realize it because they just, right, they're used to it. They're everywhere, right? Who cares?
Right. You pour fluid in it when it leaks, right, and it's fine. Right. Everything's fine.
And so that's not even getting into, like, so the engineering involved in the power steering pump, fine, but then talking about all these other things where I didn't necessarily want to go into the alignment or how all these things affect, you know, the power steering forces, but they're very important. And so the hard part is people will make suggestions that they don't understand because they don't understand the system at all, right? They just don't understand power steering systems and all the inputs and all the outputs. And that's fine. I don't expect people to. I understand it because I did it for 7 years or 8 years or whatever it was. And I literally engineered every single part of it from a standpoint of improvement and ensuring that it works the way that it's supposed to. And so it's a different thing, right? It's a very different thing.
Only 7 or 8 years. I thought it was like 15, 20 or something. But, anywho, I guess I'm trying to conceptualize it because I know I'm moving, like me, for instance, I'm moving my steering rack, which has the pump on it.
Yep.
The EPS on it.
Oh yeah, S2000
forward
parallel ball screw made by Showa. I really enjoy that rack.
Well, since I'm moving it 3 inches forward, I know I'm changing the leverage of the tie rod, so it's kind of just trying to understand it all. You know what I mean?
Right, right. So we might have to do another podcast on because it's going to take way too long. But we might have to do another podcast on EPS moving forward, like as a general EPS. But I'll answer this question. So we're talking about the S2000. The S2000 has what's called a parallel ball screw. It's made by Showa. The RX-8s have the same power steering rack. There's a couple other cars I can't remember right now, but I really do enjoy the S2000 and the RX-8 steering. If you look at old history, a lot of people talk about how great the steering is on S2000s and RX-8s. And which is funny because they're one of the first cars from a performance standpoint that had full APS. So, you know, the purebreds will be like, oh, pitchforks, it's terrible. I don't know my feedback, blah, 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 blah. Then the other people will be like, this thing's great. So a parallel ball screw has the motor wrapped around the rack for the rack and pinion. And it literally exerts a force on the rack to shuffle it back and forth. And there's a torque sensor in the pinion that determines how much that force would be. And then they've got an external module, which decides basically motor. It's the motor drivers, right? It decides how much force go through the motor. What I like about it is it has very little backlash because it's a parallel ball screw. And the ball screw is what's used in steering gears from a commercial standpoint, steering. And the technology in a ball screw is extremely good for zero backlash at this point. They've done so much that people don't realize it's not just a groove. It's a cathedral arch. It is extremely complicated. It is extremely difficult to cut well. But the matchup of the balls and the ball sizing is really cool. And it's amazing because it produces a system that is almost zero backlash, but extremely strong at the same time. Again, not necessarily understanding the complexity of the system. But the EPS for that S2000, I think, is fantastic because of that. Now, Devin's moving it because he's slapping a truck motor on top of it.
Shut the fuck up. Jesus Christ. You couldn't help
that comment.
We're having a good fucking podcast, and you just want to throw that dumb shit out there. Carry the fuck on, sir. Respectfully.
Oof. It's a 2JZ truck motor, and it's okay. Every LS is a truck motor. And so we're putting that on top of it, and obviously we need to move. The S2000 rack is positioned in a way that's, you know, very well. Like, obviously, the S2000 in a generality is almost mid-engine normally. The placement of the rack is very good, and so Devin has to move it because of this, the motor swap, the engine swap, and having to move it 3 inches forward. When doing that, there's a couple things that come into play, right? So the alignment of the tie rods will have an effect on bump steer, steering forces, and how they line up. So the angular, right, the angle of the tie rod ends is ultra important in terms of ensuring that you have a force that is directed as well as possible into the steer arms in the spindles, right? And so if you move it 3 inches forward, what could happen too is you can have bad bump steer, and because the steer arms are only a certain length on either side, you can move it out of the steering arc plane, meaning that all the tie rods aren't straight into the steer arms to start with. And if they're already starting at an angle, that angle will have a tendency to get worse, not better, when you actually steer. Because if you think about it, if your steer arms come out forward, that distance, right, is only going to get shorter as the steer arms turn, right? They only go back, if you think about it. If we're talking about in looking at the car from above, you have a steering system, you have your rack, you have your tie rod ends coming out the side. If they're vertical or they're perfectly horizontal to start with, and then you steer, no matter what, those steer arms are going straight, are the most vertical portion of that steering system to start with. Now, when you actually steer, they're actually going to become less and less because they have to steer around an arc, and that arc is going to force them to be more towards the rear of the vehicle. So if you have to move your steering system forward, right, or your power steering rack forward, then you're already contributing to steering force loss, but you're also contributing to the change in Ackerman and steering angle, because now the tie rods are already somewhat at a you know, angle towards the rear, which means they're shorter than they should be, which means that when you start turning, they're going to have a faster effect on steering force and angle, which then affects potentially Ackerman and the speed of steer of the actual, you know, vehicle. Yay. Luckily, if you tell me where it is, I can model it really quick, and then I can tell you what it's going to do.
It will do that. But in the meantime, I appreciate the education, though.
Yeah. And so, especially when you're moving racks or putting new racks in, the complication of getting that right, a lot of people just put it in and it will work. Like, I'm not saying that it won't work, but this is like anything in life. Like, I can get plenty of things to work. Or do they work well? No, but they work. And so it's how good do you want it to work? Do you want it to work extremely well? Well, for me, obviously steering is something that I, you know, I don't want to say passionate about it because I'm not necessarily passionate about it, but
take pride in.
There you go. Steering is something that I think is important to people because it's one of the main features that I think is important in a car because it is what you're connected to. For me, like I've talked about this before in terms of hands and feel and all that stuff, it's your ass, your feet, and your hands. Those are the most important things. Mm-hmm. You build a good seat, so you have a good seated position, you have good pedals, good pedal feel, good pedal feedback, and you have good steering feedback. Those are the most important aspects of a car, and if you fuck any of those up, the car's junk.
And you could probably die.
Yeah, and you're going to kill yourself, potentially.
Yeah.
So it's stuff like that I think is important to pay attention to. So luckily, we can do all those calculations. We can see what they are. We can look at bump steer. We can look at, you know, the forces involved and all of these things. And then we can kind of position the rack as best as possible. And we can, you know, best reasonably possible. And if we had to make changes to the actual steering system, whether it be the steering arm, the tie rods, offset, that kind of stuff, we can work on those things to ensure that it works as well as possible.
Now, outside of obviously contacting us, where are some resources that other people could to go to try to ballpark model things themselves?
Oh God, there is a program, but there's a program, a pretty simple program. It's about suspensions, but it also allows you to do some conceptual steering geometry questions. And I'll have to just lay it in the, we'll have to lay it in there once I find out what it is again. But I believe there's a free version of it. And it's cool because it lets you do some of these things, but only in a 2D platform. It doesn't allow you to do 3D, which is okay to start with, but it won't tell you anything about jacking forces, bump steer forces, toggle. Maybe it'll tell you about toggle a little bit. Anyway, toggle is when a wheel goes over center. Have you ever been in lots of time it happens in more in a rack or a gear-based system than a rack-based system. But if you've ever been in a car and you go to a parking lot and you turn really hard one direction and you let go of the steering wheel and it doesn't self-center and it just holds itself at the limit, that's called toggle. It means that the steering system has gone over center and is now holding itself against one edge or the other because the steering forces are no longer bringing it back to center and they're holding it at that angle, right? They want to keep going. That's called toggle. Okay?
Yes, usually when you get big tires on a truck.
Sure. Lots of trucks, it happens. It's very constant. So like if you have like an E350 or an E-van, an E-series van, you throw that bitch all the way one direction, you get out of it, it'll just drive in circles for days until the power steering pump blows up 3 minutes later.
You're right. It will keep going.
It'll, for the 3 minutes, yes, absolutely. It will keep going for that time. And that's because the system has gone over center in terms of forces and is now pulling to the outside instead of the inside, which I should say is a massive problem because I've seen it in a lot of race cars where people don't understand the system. It goes over center. And when it goes over center because of Ackerman or otherwise, right, the steering force is left versus right. And maybe the steer arms are the wrong length. You know, the angles are wrong. There's lots of opportunities here to mess up. Lots of angles here. Once it goes over center, it ain't coming back. And when it does do that, good luck. Like that's a bad feeling because not only do you have to over, what happens is, I'm sure some people who've tracked for a long time would have heard someone complain about this, is where they feel like they have to put a lot of pressure on it and then it releases and then it gets really easy all of a sudden. That's that feeling. That is toggle. It's because you're fighting to get it back to a point where it's not over center anymore and then it's snapping back to being, you know, to going with the direction of flow instead of against it. So you're building up against this wall, then the wall releases out, and then you over, you know, basically overexert yourself to get over that point. And that's scary, especially if you're in a high-speed, fully loaded turn.
Yeah, but by this time, you're already spinning backwards, wondering about life.
Yeah. No, it's after the fact if you haven't crashed. That's when you talk about it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a lot of factors here. And we can... Obviously, we're coming up on the time here. I can continue to talk if people want to talk about EPS, so I can talk about that then, and then we can talk about the feel thing I was talking about. But like I said, from a power steering system standpoint, there's a lot of variables here, a lot of factors here, and there's a lot of technicality. I tried to make it short, and I failed miserably. I got through
16, 3 pages.
Nope, that was 16 lines of my outline.
Oh, how many lines are there?
4 pages. Yeah, single spaced. yeah. Like I said this before, my outline was aggressive. And so, yeah, we can go through it. If anybody has any questions about those things, let me know. We can do that. But I'd be happy to continue this conversation if this is something that's interesting to people and they'd like to understand how, you know, systems work, power steering systems work. We could even, you know, if people have problems, like we talked about this before, people have problems with their systems, even, you know, suspension and power steering. We can come on and we can have that conversation all together.
Or our douchebag listeners won't just give us feedback and talk to us. So,
ouch.
I don't even know anymore.
Yeah, well, they listen.
I liked them at first, but
they listen, but they just won't tell us what's wrong. Tell us what's wrong. But yeah, if you have a power steering problem and you want to talk about it, you know, we could potentially have you on the podcast and we can talk through it. But I think this is something that makes us a little bit different than other people, at least from my experience, for like literally because of my experience, that we can help with suspension things, but we can also help with aero things, but we can also help with steering things, right? And all these things play a part because suspension design is critical importance to how the steering functionality works. And I've helped quite a few people over the years improve their power steering because they didn't quite understand, you know, the factors involved here. So lots of high-end race cars, top tier guys in the time attack world, those type of things, if they have power steering problems, I can help them along the way, as long as we can get the data to understand what might be wrong in the first place. So yeah, offer.
Yeah, you can't say you didn't offer. Yeah, I mean, is there anything else? I kind of want to go over some things that, you know, Hayden's been designing over there with his first prototype and whatnot. Wow, proud of him.
Whoa. Is this something we're doing in the minimal amount of time we have left?
We got like 15, 20
Okay,
minutes.
I can kind of go over it. So for the past year, yeah, that's me not being Mike Lewin, just designing things all day. Or, well, I take that back. I design things all day, but I do it for work and not for my play. I'm designing a higher volume air intake for the 1.8 liter Mark 1 GTI engine. So the stock inlet is just a super shitty box that has some kind of crappy plastic connection to a corrugated hose, basically, that runs down into the bumper, and that sucks some air out of the bumper and up into the air box. And there isn't a great solution out there to put like a cold air intake filter on a Mark 1, and you can't make your inlet size any larger unless you did something like what I did. So I've been slowly piecing together the CAD for the airbox to get it set up properly, basically the same as stock. There's a bracket on the underneath side that hooks it up just right up to the bracket that's OEM, so that you could use this in the Rabbit, the Scirocco, and the Cabriolet, since they all have the same bracketry. And basically it puts the cold air intake underneath the battery tray away from the engine in a pretty nice area where heat isn't just getting dumped onto it. That it's a little tightly packed underneath there, so I'm still working on like getting it properly set up underneath there, but I'm hoping that by both increasing the diameter that I can get a little more air that way, and then directing the flow instead of like up into the just plastic box. I've actually got it pointed directly at the Venturi flap in the CIS system so that the air is flowing directly into the flap and not into the box and then just around inside. I'm hoping that improves performance a little bit. And then it also gives me an option. I made it so that you can take the inlet elbow off and I can print different sized elbows. So if I see that I need to decrease my horsepower in Sunday Cup and I want to choke the airflow a little bit, I could switch from like a 3-inch inlet to a 2-inch inlet simply by taking the elbow off and putting a different elbow on. I'll print off a piece that ends at a 3-inch that adapts to my airbox but starts at a 2-inch inlet down at the bottom with a filter on it. So I'm hoping that that gives me a little bit of range without doing some really shady like throttle stopping or choking flow with just a restrictor plate or something like that. I'm hoping that this gets a, a slightly cleaner solution where, like, at any range of use, it's not hindering me, or it's hindering me evenly rather than differently in a lower range versus a higher range. But yeah, that's what I've been after.
I mean, it makes sense. I mean, it looks good. I mean, everything for that extra 2 to 3 horsepower and 100 horsepower.
But it's funny, but that's exactly what it is.
Something that makes 6 horsepower.
That's exactly what it is. It's literally to make like 6 horsepower.
At 20% more.
But when you think that the fucking engine's going to make like 93 horsepower, 6 horsepower percentile wise, that's a decent increase. Especially to the weight. So being able to play with that kind of freely, that's
without doing other things.
Yeah, right. Hopefully it's an easy solution. And it's also really easy to remove. This isn't a very complicated part to remove either. So just taking it off inside the car would just mean like undoing 4 M6 bolts and then just bolting up another piece that's the same size. So it really shouldn't take a lot to switch them out if it's an option that I need to use. So that's nice.
Simple and reliable.
Yeah.
Sounds like you're becoming a good engineer,
right?
Huh?
Something like that.
All right, I see.
Something
you.
Like that. That's fun.
I think stuff like that, like I said before, I think stuff like that is important to have to go down to the nitty-gritty level of designing something from scratch to decide, basically make choices that you're not thinking about on a daily basis. Most people aren't thinking about the choices that you've made on a daily basis, right? And I think that doing things like that is helpful.
Yeah.
So you can better understand the system.
Right, absolutely. And like it has brought me down, like, due to the fact that I've had to really think through how I want to direct airflow, because it started by just dumping it into the box similar to OEM. And then I'm like, wait, I could improve the flow. I mean, I work with radiators. I understand, you know. Intercooler, it's the same idea. You're trying to direct flow without making things into sharp elbows. You want smooth lines, as straight as possible in this case, and that kind of thing. So I was able to apply some of that stuff that I learned to what I was doing, and then yeah, I'm just making something that it'll have a very niche market, but I know there are a lot of people out there that wanted something else. And yeah. What's really cool is there's one other group that makes something similar-ish, but they make something closer to OEM, where they actually just changed it to a 3-inch inlet, but it goes back down to the bumper inlet instead of being able to be adapted to a filter. And then everything else, like the other stuff that I've seen, is people literally use the metal airbox from like 240 Volvos. They've like adapted that and welded those together because it's roughly the same, like the top CIS frame is the same bolt pattern as the Volkswagen. So there's not really a solution out there. And for the people who are, you know, looking for something and still using the same shit, it kind of makes sense because you're forced to use it. There's no other way to get around it unless you go to electric fuel injection.
Right.
With that engine anyway.
So I've got one last question for you. And the design process, what stage would you consider yourself at? Like, you got your rough stage, right? Your first sure. putting the idea together and then your final product. Like, what in between those two, where you, let's say 10 is final, 1 is rough. Where would you think you're at?
I'm at like a 7. So this one going out should fit in the car. I can't guarantee that the filter is going to be in the location that I want. He's actually sending one of his working prototypes he has on his car to me. Sorry, I'm working with another individual, but it's simply for fitment. I'm doing all of the design. So he's going to get it. He's going to send me his prototype. I'm going to scan it, and then I'm going to adapt what he has in the way of the way his inlet's shaped to my design, which should take like almost no effort. And then I need to figure out how to print it better so that it can be mass produced as a print rather. And then eventually I'd like to injection mold these, but
there's like small tweaks for functionality. Like I figured out that I want bolts to be tapped longer distances. I need holes that are longer instead of like short threaded sections. I kind of want to change the bracket very ever so slightly. It's easy enough to bend. It shouldn't be too hard to bend. It's easy to cut out. It little tweaks, but the product is there. I put it all together, and now it's just like ironing out the steps it would take to function properly, and then the steps it takes to manufacture. So I'm very well. I'm deep into the end of prototyping.
Fantastic, pretty dope, man.
Yeah, I mean it's exciting. It's fun being able to apply myself to something that, it's gonna give me something. It's gonna go on my car, which is really cool. Something I made specifically to enhance performance of my vehicle and other people who drive the same vehicle. So that's a neat feel for sure. But obviously, being able to put it on a dyno and test, I also intend to get a bunch of different filter sizes and elbow sizes, and then try to test them out before I get into Sunday Cup, because I have to meet the weight to power ratio. So if I have to decrease power or increase weight, then I hope that I can see a difference in my performance by just swapping this piece as one of the.
Just remember these folks, this is all just to be the Honda fit.
Yeah.
All
yep.
He wants to do.
Yep. Yep. In a Volkswagen.
That's pure dedication and anger right there, mm-hmm. Boys.
Painful.
Fuck the fit. I said it.
Take that.
Yep. So, yeah, I guess that's been 10 minutes, but we're German shitbox collectors. Are you going to introduce the working force out there to your German shitbox?
I'll wait till next time. They don't need to know about top secret plans yet.
Top secret, but it's posted all over his Instagram, so go look at it on Instagram.
Stop worrying about it.
Stop being aggressive. Okay. Matter of fact, we're ending this right now. It's that time again, boys. I need those goddamn reviews. You can say that Devin is forcing you to do them, or you can leave some genuine feedback, and I'll be sure to read them and get them back to the boys. In the meantime, you can join our Facebook group, which is Professional Awesome Technical Forum. You can follow us on Instagram at Professional Awesome Racing, and we have a Facebook regular page with the same name. But until then, we'll talk to you later, and we really appreciate you listening.